You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
This is KCBS In-Depth. I'm Matt Bigler. This is a special two-part episode of In-Depth, a conversation about artificial intelligence at San Jose State University.
There's so many things to listen to these days, podcasts and streaming. Good old-fashioned radio is still alive and well. So KCBS actually traces its roots right here to the first radio broadcasts in the world in 1909. Does anyone know where those broadcasts first happened? Well, the panel didn't know either. Right here in San Jose, this is where the very first radio broadcast started in 1909. I think at 50 San Fernando. The building is long gone. But those broadcasts, which kind of sounded like, this is San Jose calling, later became KQW, which later became KCBS.
This is KCBS in San Francisco. KCBS News at Dawn.
That's from some of our historic sound bites from the way that KCBS used to sound. So why am I boring you with the history of radio? You came here to learn about AI, right? Well, radio allowed people to communicate for the first time over vast distances, and in many ways kicked off the information revolution that we are still living in now. In what we now call Silicon Valley, technological leaps forward have happened again and again and again. Semiconductors, microprocessors, memory storage, personal computers, the internet, Web 2.0, mobile.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
That was Steve Jobs in 2007. We'll round out the list with social media, big data, machine learning, and now AI. Somehow AI seems different from all of these other advancements. Never before has there been so much promise that technology could make our lives easier, while at the same time, so much concern over how AI may threaten our jobs and maybe even make human intelligence obsolete. To talk more about this, let's introduce our panel of experts. First of all, we have Vincent Del Casino, Provost and Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at San Jose State. Dr. Del Casino's primary role is encouraging academic excellence, but he's also a prolific writer and has penned articles about health, robotics, robotic technologies, and commentaries on machine learning, big data, and the future of higher education. Let's give him a warm round of applause. Georgetta Jetcheva, Assistant Professor in the Computer Engineering Department at San Jose State. Her current research focuses on AI-based personal assistance, natural language processing, and knowledge management. Before entering academia, Dr. Jetcheva worked in the private sector at Accenture, Fujitsu Research, as well as other startups specializing in virtual and robotic assistance. Dr. Jetcheva. Neha Marwa is a current student here at San Jose State, majoring in Management Information Systems. As a research assistant at the Lucas College and Graduate School of Business, she's helped to develop three apps to help other students, including AI for Social Good, funded by the National Science Foundation. Please, let's give her a warm welcome. And lastly, on stage right, Stephen Keynes, Chief Innovation Officer and Budget Director at the City of San Jose, as well as a senior advisor to Mayor Matt Mahan. Before working for the city, Stephen completed a two-year residential fellowship at CodeX, the Stanford Center for Legal Informatics, specializing in the ethics of facial recognition and surveillance. Let's give him a warm welcome. And really, I'm the one who's from out of this. Actually, Steve and I are off campus, so thank you for welcoming us here. So I've broken down our conversation into five topics. What is AI? How is AI being used? Is AI going to make my job easier or take my job? Should we be worried about a future where we rely too much on AI? And lastly, how to prepare for an AI future? Let's start with number one. Who would like to tell us what AI is? Maybe Dr. Jecheva, would you like to start that?
Sure. I'll take a crack at it. So AI has been defined in many different ways by many different people. The way I would define it for our conversation here is that, of course, there are two components, artificial, so created, usually by humans, and then intelligence. And intelligence itself is something that has been hotly debated, but generally speaking, we refer to intelligence as the display of behavior that shows reasoning capabilities, that shows understanding. And of course, there's another question that always comes up when we have this conversation, which is the behavior or appearance of intelligence enough, or do we want there to be actual reasoning in the back as well?
Hmm. So intelligence and also the ability to reason.
Yes.
Any other definitions that you'd like to throw out there, panel?
Well, I'll jump in because I think one of the big challenges we have socially, and by the way, I thought your third question should be why is AI, you know?
Why AI?
What, how, and why is AI? But the question really around intelligence is a really important one, because what we're seeing right now socially is sort of a seeding of intelligence to the artificial, and really what we're at right now is not AI, but IA. It's really intelligence augmented. Right? It's really about how we've extended ourselves as humans into the world. And what intelligence means is a philosophical question as well as a question of technology. And so when we think about that, I think it's very important for us to hold on to that intelligence is always already informed by all the stuff we do as people. Right, all the data that go into it, all the thinking, the ways in which we engage is a human activity, and that intelligence is largely at this point an extension of the human as much as an augmentation of the human as much as it is a replacement of the human.
Now, sorry if I'm wrong, but AI is basically scraping a bunch of data that's already out there thanks to the internet and putting it in a user-friendly form. That's the large language models that we're talking about, but you guys are here to educate me.
Well, I think my colleagues could talk more eloquently about it. I mean, there's generative AI, and there's a lot of other types of AI. Generative AI is the one that's kind of hit the roadmap because it impacted so many people all of a sudden. But AI has a long history, and I think my colleagues could probably jump in and dive in more deeply about the different kinds of things that are working in that space.
How does AI work? In layman's terms?
So, and again, just AI has so many definitions for so many different people. It also is very frequently used kind of as a marketing term to, sell products or attract funding, et cetera. And there are many different technologies that are referred to as part of the AI ecosystem. And in some cases, they're very simple things. So AI, you know, is it really intelligent that when you get into your car, your navigation system immediately keys in your directions to work in the morning on weekdays? It could seem intelligent, but really, it's very simple kind of tracking of, you know, what happens during different days of the week and remembering that the most common thing that perhaps you do, the most common place you drive to is your work. So there are different levels of this behavior where we've collected data and then we're, and the technology is making recommendations based on that data. When we get into things like generative AI, where we have these large language models, like ChatGPT, which is based on those, where the algorithms have been exposed to a lot of data, a lot of textual data, and they have learned a lot of the mathematical properties of the data, and it turns out that if you've seen enough text, you can start to kind of predict the most likely next word, which is the basic form of this technology, and you can package that in a way that now you can generate what look like answers to questions. But really in the back, It's kind of a statistical, mathematical calculation of what is more likely to come next as a word.
It's a predictor.
Yes. Hmm.
Neha, I wonder if you could share with us about the prompt, because I think one of the ways that most of us are becoming familiar with AI is through these chatbots where you use the prompt, and you have to know how to craft the right prompt to get the result that you want.
So the practice of actually writing prompts is called prompt engineering. Hmm. And it sounds sometimes like a scary word, but it's not an engineering compared to robotics or what you see in software engineering. But in fact, it's an art of writing prompts, which is basically how you ask questions to AI in a precise way so that you get more relevant answers. So say you are studying for recycling. If you simply go and ask ChatGPT, tell me more about recycling. Mm-hmm. The answer you are going to get is very surface level, very topical information. But if you go ahead and refine that, and let's say you ask ChatGPT that, you know, you are a recycling expert, you have 25 years of experience, can you tell me how recycling works? How it's important for the environment, and can you tell me things that can and cannot be recycled? This will give you a very detailed, very focused response. But your work doesn't end here, because AI can make mistakes. It doesn't always get everything right. So you have to ask AI to give you sources. And still, the work isn't done yet. You have to go and check if those sources exist. And they do provide similar information that ChatGPT has provided you or any AI that you are using has provided you. Because at the end of the day, there have been cases where AI would just make some stuff up. And it's also in terms of resources, the sources that it provides or the information that it's providing. Mm. So you really have to be careful and you really have to use your critical thinking skills as to the information that's given to you, if it's relevant, if it's useful.
Any other examples of using the prompt and these different AI products that you'd like to share?
One thing I like to just add is what we refer to as the human in the loop. And so I think that when we think about what problems is AI really suited for, it's not just about the initial efficacy of it. It's about how much time does it frankly take to double check. And so when you think about systems and trade-offs and time, we also have to think about how much time do these oversight mechanisms cost, and is the benefit still worth it once you take that into account?
Hmm. Do we still need the humans to do that, or do we have AI that can do the checking?
Absolutely. I would say that there are a few select cases where you may not need it and the stakes are relatively low. If you think about, let's say, predicting weather. If you're just a regular person trying to decide, do I need a raincoat tomorrow? It may not be life or death, but if you're a meteorologist, so like right before a major hurricane, you absolutely do want to report that before you communicate that back to your constituents or whoever your audience is. So I think it's really about understanding what are the stakes and who will be most impacted by the decision making from this that determines the strength of the human system specifically in the loop and the role that you play in that oversight mechanism.
I think what's critical in all of this is there's a developing dialogue between humans and robotic technologies. And if you think about the future of work, how we're training students or where you're going out and doing these sorts of things, you're going to realize that at some level in these prompts, you're not asking one question, you're iterating in conversation. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about this is the pace at which that can happen now. So I can have multiple sets of conversations back and forth, refine that question, I don't understand where you got that source, pull that out. And what that does allow you to do, optimistically, at least for me, is it allows you to then learn what's out there in a different way. But you are obviously always ground truthing those data, right? You're trying to figure out if they're real or not, what's coming to. But it is interesting to think about the different ways, and you can create personas that you could have conversations with. I want to talk to a professor of computer engineering about this question, and all of a sudden you're having a different conversation. That's an interesting moment for us, and that technology wasn't necessarily so democratically available before. It was limited to people who could really understand how to build those algorithms and have those discussions.
Let's move on to topic number two. How is AI being used? And we've touched upon this already. Here is one example that I did a story on this week.
AI startup 11 Labs, which is based in New York, sorry, not Silicon Valley, has been able to recreate an AI voice model of Grateful Dead frontman Jerry Garcia. They've also done other celebrity voices. Cool, but also kind of creepy. Any other examples that you'd like to share about groundbreaking ways that AI is being used?
Yeah, I'm happy to share some from the civic context.
Please.
So transportation is one of the biggest issues that we deal with as a city. It's really our duty to make sure that you can get to home and back, not only efficiently, but also safely. And so one way that we're using AI in the city of San Jose is integrating AI into our traffic signaling. And so our Department of Transportation is working with the Valley Transportation Authority to integrate AI into traffic signaling with the goal of giving buses specifically priority at lights to encourage folks to take public transportation. And from this, we've been able to see a 15% decrease in the amount of travel time, which is really wonderful to see how we're getting micro gains. And when applied to a city as large as San Jose, there's really big impacts on not only people riding the bus, but the folks around you who will experience less congestion if everybody's not driving their own vehicle. The second thing I'd like to offer is for 311, which is known as your digital front door to send to the city. This is the way that you report potholes, abandoned vehicles, and the like. Right now, we frankly rely on manual reporting, which means you yourself as a resident have to take out your phone, fill out a report, and submit it. We'd like to get to a place where we can proactively identify a lot of these issues. And so there's an idea specifically where if you attach cameras to fleet vehicles pointed at the ground, you can identify things like potholes, mattresses, and bike lanes and other obstructions that can essentially be able to allow our workforce to know about the issues very early on, and then we can be better at intervening and actually providing some of that service delivery. And then the final thing I'll quickly add is language access, which many of you have maybe already heard. So San Jose has the largest overseas Vietnamese population in the world. So from the city's perspective, anytime we communicate, it has to be in English, Spanish, and Vietnamese. We found that if you take Google's base algorithm and then you take our years of training data and certain assessments, we outperform Google's model. And so we had the very simple thought, other cities have these dense ethnic populations. What if the city of San Jose created an open data portal where we can all pull our training data and all improve our models collectively as cities trying to serve our residents? And even within the city, we've been able to see an over 300% increase in the Spanish viewership for city council meetings, which suggests when you make doors easier for people to walk through, civic participation rises. So transportation and then also community and civic engagement are two areas that we're applying AI to in the city of San Jose.
Almost any area, AI can be a tool. About the buses, and I just want to drill into this a little bit more. How does it work? I'm picturing camera data is being pulled by AI to know when buses are arriving and departing. Can you explain that a little bit more? Yeah.
So not even necessarily a camera. And to take a quick step back, if you think about technology, there are these things called rule-based systems, which are just, as it sounds, just clear mandates of when things will happen. If you think about a bus schedule, you could, in theory, say, hey, we anticipate that this bus will cross this street at this time because we know that there's a bus stop. But in the real world, things don't always happen on that sequence. There's often construction. There might be emergency vehicles that cause you to take a detour. So the AI is actually a transponder that's on the bus that's communicating real time. So it has an understanding of where the bus should be in this hypothetical rules-based system. But the magic of the AI specifically there is that it's able to communicate real time where the bus is and then predict when the bus will come and approach that specific intersection. So it can take into account the moving parameters of the bus, and it combines that with the known schedule. And that's where the magic of the AI specifically is, which brings you the reduced wait times and travel times as well.
It's, again, using that predictive power.
Exactly.
And you've saved 15 minutes on average?
15% on bus traveling rides, yes.
Wow. This might be a good segue to ask Dewa about some of the apps that you've developed using AI.
So I have developed three apps that are currently being used by students. So first one is a Python tutor. So basically, that app puts students in a feedback-rich environment where they get weekly assignments based on Python programming language. And so the first step that they have to go and do is they have to answer that question themselves. And the first step does not give them the right answer. Once they enter their answer, it actually looks for weaknesses and tries to give them hints as to what or how they can correct the code. And then after they have corrected the code, it moves on and it helps students actually learn how to actually think about the problem step by step. Because a lot of times these problems, we have some intuition that, you know, this is how it should be solved. But we really don't know what is the right way of thinking or why this thing is even correct. So it's very important for students to learn that thing that, you know, this is the way the problem should be solved. This is the right way of thinking. If I get a similar problem, that's how it should think about it. Then the next step is, the next step actually creates similar questions so that students can actually practice the skill that they have just learned. And then the fourth step actually lists all the common themes that were in the assignments, and they can just choose whichever theme that they think that, you know, they are not very clear at, like lists and tuples, what is the difference between them. So once they use that, they can actually learn about those concepts and have much clarity. So that is one app. The second app is...
If I can ask a quick question, yeah. How does it know what to hint about?
So that's the thing. So we use AI when the question is given, and say you have a line of code. You are missing a semicolon, or you did not put the variables in the right place, the positional variables, which should come first, which should come last. So then it has the question, and then it has the answer. So based on that, it can create feedback that this is where you are going wrong. The positional variable is not correct. The positional argument is not correct. Mm. So that's where it suggests that, you know, this is maybe where you have to correct the answer.
Hmm. And what's the name of that app?
It's called Python Tutor.
Python Tutor, okay.
Right. And then we have the second app, which is the brainstorming app, which helps students brainstorm ideas, which can be based on AI for social good. So a lot of times, and from a personal experience, my experiences, my values, and whatever I have seen in life, actually limit me to my own problems that I have seen or the ones that I have seen around. But the thing is, there are a lot of pain points, a lot of problems that I don't understand because I have never been with those people. I have never been with that part of the society. So when we have to do projects and we are doing AI for social good projects and we are focusing on the community, the problems that they face, AI can help generate a lot of ideas that students can then use to address those problems. And which brings me to the third app, which is basically which works in conjunction with the brainstorming app, which creates personas or user profiles, where it creates a diverse set of profiles where students can understand what are the pain points, what are the opportunities they can address, what are the problems that a lot of people that they are not aware of might be facing, and how they can use that to make their app multidimensional and solve many problems instead of just addressing one.
Well, thank you for explaining all three of those apps. That's amazing work. Let's move to topic number three, and we will continue to talk about some of the amazing ways that AI is being used. Is AI going to take my job or make my job easier? In recent months, tech companies and non-tech companies have announced thousands of layoffs, in many cases outsourcing those jobs to AI. And a lot of the time it is mundane procedural stuff that artificial intelligence can just do better. So I guess the question is, what are some examples of jobs that we may not need anymore?
All right, we're not going to say provost.
Not provost, but hopefully not journalists.
But I don't know, I think an AI could do provost. Here's the thing I'm going to say, bigger picture. Over the last 400 years, we've had major technological moments, disruptions in economies. And each time there's been some level of response to create new jobs and new opportunities and things like that. So I think the answer to the question is yes and yes. Jobs are going to be lost and jobs are going to be created. We don't quite know what they are. But what I've taken away so far from just having this conversation is how important the human interaction with these computing systems remains, and I think will remain for quite some time. So the real question becomes, you know, how do we train people in prompt engineering such that they can take that and apply it into different parts of the economy? I do think there are questions of a basic living wage that emerge because people are very concerned about these high levels of unemployment that'll happen. That may or may not take place. We may respond more broadly as a society demographically, which has also happened with major transformation, where we go, well, maybe we don't have as big a family anymore. Those kind of things start to emerge over time as we respond to the technological change. But there, I will tell you, in higher ed, there were arguments at the University of Wisconsin in 1900 or so that correspondence education was going to destroy higher ed, that mailing out and letting people learn at home was going to ruin the industry and the economy. And as we know, none of that happened. What it did instead is it opened up access to communities that had a hard time making their way to that institution. I think that's what's going to happen, is we're going to have these constant responses and engagement, and we're going to find new ways in which work is going to emerge out of that. And I think that's a consistent theme. So I live between the moments of techno-optimism and techno-pessimism as it relates to the future of work. I do think people's jobs are going to continue to change more often. And that's a reality, and the upskilling that's going to happen. And where do we respond as a society to give people those opportunities? That's why I love partnerships with the city, for example, where we can think about that civic engagement and how we get those tools in people's hands quickly so that they can respond to the workforce demands.
Stephen, do you know of any jobs at the city that are either leaving because of AI or being complemented because of AI tools?
I would say the first thing that comes to mind is around translation. We were very heavily reliant on specifically human translators, but you know, to be frank, there were certain moments where people were available at the right times, or let's say for very long council meetings, which may run 6-7 hours sometimes, there's a little bit of fatigue that sets in. And you know, to be frank, when you're having complex conversations about policy, if you miss 20 seconds of an argument or some type of presentation, it may be very crucial to your entire understanding. And so I think that being able to get to a place where every instance something's being translated on screen for English, Spanish, and Vietnamese listeners has been very crucial to us specifically. But I really second the provost's comments about how there's going to be a lot of transformation moving forward. And you know, one thing I think about frequently is that every industry has their own risk tolerance, and that risk tolerance will shift. If you think about medicine, many of you have heard how AI can read radiography, which is great. But there's going to be a lot of other things which I think will still require a human touch. My partner has just started grad school to become a physical therapist, and I remember she was very fearful of specifically, is this even a good idea? Will it be relevant? And even though ChatGPT may be able to suggest at some level, let's say, treatment plans, if you get that original diagnosis wrong and it's actually the muscle to the left and not to the right, you will not have a good healing plan or recovery. And so I still think that there's instances, especially with like intake in terms of medicine, that we're going to need to have a human there, not only for the softer skills of someone who's providing medical care, but also just to make sure the initial step is right and to provide that human in the loop review. So I think we're definitely going to see periods of transformation, but I think the human will still need to be present for many of these systems.
Especially if we're talking about physical therapy, I think you still need a human to push on the right muscles. Yeah. We haven't got a robot that can do that yet.
You've been listening to KCBS In-Depth, recorded at San Jose State University. Tune in next week for part two of our conversation about artificial intelligence. I'm Matt Bigler, KCBS.
You've been listening to KCBS In-Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.